Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the ancient city of Jerusalem and how it has captured the imagination of the world over thousands of years. We'd love you to join our discussion. Just send us a text to 53106. Text costs 30 cents, or you can email us at talkinghistory@newstalk.com. Last week, we went in search of the lost city of Solomon, investigated the controversy over Irish water and how it divided the country, and debated the role played by lawyers and the law in 17th century Ireland. And that was in our monthly book show. And if you want to listen back to this or any of our older shows, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. I'd also like to wish a happy birthday to my nephew, Jack, 17 years old today. He was meant to be in Ireland this summer. He lives in New Jersey. He was meant to be over here. Sadly, the world changed and he was not able to make it, but we do wish him a very happy birthday and hope he is having a great day. In tonight's show, we're exploring the history of the universal city, Jerusalem. According to the Bible, it was the city of David and the capital of the Kingdom of Israel. Later, when under Roman rule, it was where Jesus was crucified and became the birthplace of early Christianity. It's also where Muslims believe that Muhammad ascended to heaven, and so it is a place of unique significance for three religions: Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. Jerusalem has long been a contested city, a city of conflict, but it is also a city that has been praised for casting more of a spell over the human imagination than any other city in the world. And so in tonight's show, we're going to focus on that part of the story, from the ancient beginnings to the present-day architecture, as we explore the history of the ancient city of Jerusalem. This isn't going to be a show about politics, much less a show about the present. Instead, we're approaching this from a different angle, going further back in time to the ancient origins of Jerusalem and their relevance and significance today. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. I'm delighted to be joined by the Deputy Ambassador of the Embassy of Israel in Dublin, Mrs. Orly Weitzman, a native of Jerusalem, Dr. Zalika Rogers, Associate Professor in Jewish Studies and the Head of the Department of Near and Middle Eastern Studies at Trinity College Dublin. She's an expert on the first century Judean historian Flavius Josephus. David Cryanker, an architect and architectural historian who has written extensively on Jerusalem. His books include the six-volume series Architecture in Jerusalem, and most recently the acclaimed four-volume set, Jerusalem Design, God is in the Details. Rabbi Dr. Chaim Perlmutter, who specialises in teaching in-depth Torah studies, as well as Jewish thought and belief and Jewish history, and he's the author of Tools for Tosafos, among other works. You're all very welcome. And later in the show, I'll be talking to Dr. Issam Nassar of the Department of History at Illinois State University, and he's an expert on the history of the modern Middle East, as well as being an historian of photography. Well, as I say, you're all very welcome. But Orly, I might begin with you, and I might begin with the way Jerusalem, it's a space, it's a city that resonates with people of many religious backgrounds, and that's maybe part of the charm of the ancient city.
Yes, so first of all, good evening. It's very good to talk to you and talk about Jerusalem, which to me is just a home. And you're absolutely right. I think that one of the most special feelings about Jerusalem is the feeling that you get when you're in Jerusalem and you actually understand what cosmopolitan city really means, because there are people there from everywhere. If you get on a bus, you'll see Muslims, Jews, Christians, all in different kinds of Christians, different kinds of Jews, you know, secular Jews, religious Jews, Orthodox Jews, different kinds of Christianity, different sectors of Christianity, and different sectors of Islam as well. So I think it's very, very it's a very special feeling, because you really see everything, and everything is very natural, and it all happens very, you know, in every place you look. So it's a really great feeling, and it does make the city very, very special.
And David, it's fascinating. Tonight's show is really about the old city of Jerusalem. And I wonder how much of that remains, or how much of it has been integrated into the newer parts of Jerusalem.
The old city has four sections. One is Muslim, one is the Christian, the other one is Armenian, and the other is Jewish. And they exist for hundreds of years. Now, there is a great difference between the city within the old city walls, which was built in the 16th century, by the Ottomans, and the city outside the old city, which is really a relatively new city of about 170 years only. So it's really the old, the ancient, as opposed to the new city of Jerusalem, which has many, many neighborhoods which are very similar, some of them at least, to those in the old city. We have the German colony, we have the Ethiopian quarter, we have the ultra-Orthodox Me'ah She'arim quarter, and we have a variety of different religions and people of different characters in the city which surrounds the old city.
And Zilika, it's fascinating. You've lived there, you studied there. What are the first of all, what was that like, and what are the elements of the old city that really stands out for you?
Thank you, Patrick. I can't say I'm from Jerusalem, but I spent a great deal of my life in Jerusalem, and I feel it's a second home. I went there first as a young graduate student studying Jewish antiquity, and having never been to the Middle East at all, never mind to Jerusalem, all of a sudden I arrive and the texts came alive. And I think that's one of the most extraordinary things when you arrive in Jerusalem, is these texts that have informed so much of Western culture and also Eastern culture as well, Middle Eastern culture, come alive in one place. And what I should say is not just the study of the religion, the religions of Jerusalem, but also what you see is the place Jerusalem has played in the realpolitik of the Middle East and also in Europe as well. I mean, you can see from antiquity, you can see in the Greek interests, the Hellenistic interests, the Romans, Byzantine Christians, Muslims, Crusaders, Mamluks from Cairo, the Ottomans, of course, was just mentioned, who built the current walls of Jerusalem. So all of this coming together in one very small place, because Jerusalem is very small. So every time you turn a corner in Jerusalem, there's something interesting there, not just for if you're religious, but if you're interested in history. And it's not even that. There's an energy in Jerusalem because this has been a focus of so many people's hopes, of their lamentations, of their, you know, future aspirations. And you can feel all of those things come together in Jerusalem.
And you're walking through history, but you're not just walking through one history, you're walking through different histories. Nice. Because people from different backgrounds will interpret different things, and they believe different things about the history and the story of Jerusalem. So it's part of, I suppose, the what makes it such a unique place, that there are all these kind of competing interpretations.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I wrote my doctorate on the first century historian Flavius Josephus, who really is our main source for the rebellion against Rome, but also for Herodian Jerusalem and Roman Jerusalem. And we are still debating what led to the first revolt. There is absolutely no consensus about that. So, yes, everyone is still arguing. And of course, there's still archaeological digs and we're still uncovering things. I was very privileged when I lived there. I was at the École Biblique in Jerusalem, which was set up in 1890. And in the 19th century and in the early part of the 20th century, the European powers became very interested in Jerusalem, of course, with the rediscovery of the land of the Bible. And what the École Biblique did, they were French Dominicans who set up an archaeological and biblical school. And they really believed that if you wanted to understand these ancient texts, you needed a command of the languages, but you also needed to understand the topography and geography. And I think if anyone goes to Jerusalem, you must start and say, OK, why did somebody settle here? Let's look at the hillside. Let's look at the topography before we even begin to try to dig down further into, you know, from the Iron Age all the way up to the present. We can look at the different aspects of the city.
And Rabbi Haim, it is interesting the way it has a special spiritual significance for people of many different religions, for Jews, for Christians, for Muslims, and so many different parts, fundamental parts of these religions are centered around the city of Jerusalem.
Oh, yes, indeed so. There's something called the Jerusalem Syndrome. That is a psychological state that people tend to become extra religious when they come to Jerusalem, even if they weren't like that before. It could even lead them, unfortunately, to what we would call mental illness. It's a type of mental illness. But really the reason for it is the tremendous power of the place, that every stone speaks about divinity, about it brings you back in time. It sort of takes you away from the modern world that is so technological, and sort of brings you back to the fundamentals of humanity and his relationship with God, or her relationship with God, in this place. And it's not a mistake that all three monotheistic religions see Jerusalem as their source.
And I know that you lived for many years in Jerusalem, and I think perhaps even in the old part of the city. If you were taking our listeners on a tour through these ancient remains and up through the old city, where would you take them?
Yeah, so I've lived for a number of years in the old city of Jerusalem, and I find it most fascinating to actually start in the Shiloh Pool, which is down the valley in the city of David. Today it's the residential area called the Siloam Village. There is an ancient pool of water that King Hezekiah, from the first temple period, took the water and brought it inside the walls of Jerusalem so that the Assyrians attacking him wouldn't be able to get a hold of the water. Recently, archaeologists discovered that under the modern street, you can find the ancient street that leads straight up from there, 600 meters, to the area of the arch that enters the Temple Mount. Most of us know the western wall of the Temple Mount, but the southern wall is even more interesting, because they discovered there gates that people would enter the Temple Mount from there, and stairs that would lead to the Temple Mount, including ritual baths in which people would bathe before they would climb up the Temple Mount. So it must have been an awesome experience walking up that street and reaching the area which today is the where the public area next to the western wall, and then going toward the southern wall, immersing yourself in a pure pool, and then going up into the awesome temple that Herod had built. That was a tremendous enlargement of the area of the Temple Mount that existed in the first century. I mean, the first temple. Sorry, first temple period.
Very good. And
I would take people up that road and tell them, as we're going up the road, that underneath that road, that would mean already a third level below ground level of today, there was the sewage or the underground hiding places of the warriors who fought against Rome, and as a last resort tried to hide under there and were pulled out and killed by the Roman soldiers, as Josephus tells in his Wars of the Jews.
Very interesting. And Orly, I wonder, is there anything that you would like to add as a native of Jerusalem? Are there any parts of the old city that you would, for example, what would be the first place in the old city that you would bring a visitor?
So first of all, I take them, I think one of the first things I do with visitors in Jerusalem is take them to eat really good hummus. So I think there are lots of really good restaurants in the old city and around the old city, and I think that's part of the experience, and the culinary experience, the market in the old city, and just to look at the different vibes that happen there. One of my favorite places today is the Tower of David, which is a museum telling the history of Jerusalem, and they have today in the modern times they now have amazing sound and light shows that tell the history of Jerusalem in such a spectacular way that it's really unbelievable how beautiful and how exciting and how alive this can seem when you're watching it in a very modern way in a very old and ancient place. So on the walls themselves, there are all these lights and sounds that are projected, and it's just this amazing experience of watching this modern technique on very, very ancient walls. And I think just being in Jerusalem, if you're just walking, for me, I usually go in through the Jaffa Gate, but where there's like a mall right outside, like an outdoor mall right outside of the gates, right outside of the old city. And I think that to me is like a very, it's an amazing place because you can really get the contrast between the ancient and the new, like in within, 10 minutes or 5 minute walk. And it's amazing because, Israel is considered the startup nation. So there are a lot of modern buildings, modern companies. The most innovative things are being invented right outside of where these very ancient archaeological findings exist. So I think just being in that area is amazing.
And Rabbi Haim, let's go back to the Bible then, and let's look at this original city on the hill and how it became the city of David.
There we have a very interesting passage in Samuel 2. It tells about how King David conquered the city. It says there he touched the pipe. And actually, an English officer interpreted that passage to mean that we're talking about a pipe that leads into the city, a water pipe. And indeed, he went and he excavated, and he found this water pipe, and it's possible to see it. There's a museum for it right outside Dung Gate, and you can see that pipe. I would also like to mention new excavations that have found two names on signatures that were used like for stamps on official documents. One was Baruch ben Neriah, and the other one was Gemariahu, son of Shaphan. Baruch, son of Neriah, according to the book of Jeremiah, was Jeremiah's disciple, to whom Jeremiah dictated a document that he read in the ears of the corrupt king Jehoiakim or Joiakim. And the king took the paper and burned it. Of course, the king was severely punished by God and ended up killed by the Babylonians. The other one belongs to Gemariahu, son of Shaphan, who was one of the officials in Jehoiakim's court, and in which his courtyard, Baruch, the disciple of Neriah, spoke out against the corruption of Jehoiakim, who was an idol worshiper, and the prophet complains that he exploits the poor and uses their money to live in a luxurious way. So it's like these stamps were found in recent excavations in what is called the Golani parking lot, which is no longer a parking lot, but it used to be a parking lot. And in it, they discovered the administrative center of the city of David in the later part of the first temple, including a massive building that they think was Jehoiakim's palace. So it's amazing to see how the Bible comes to life in excavations in Jerusalem, and how we find names straight from the Bible written on pottery or on stone, and as if they're coming to tell us, here, we exist, we were actually there, all you have to do is come here and learn about us.
Very good. Zalika, it would be impossible we would need a 10-part series to cover even the ancient history of Jerusalem and the different battles and the takeovers and so on. But it's interesting. The city of David, his son Solomon, the home of the Ark of the Covenant, a lot of history then until we get to the Roman period that you specialize in. But what I think all these periods have in common is it's a contested site, and it is somewhere where you have different claims on it, and different takeovers, and each one adds a different layer to the history.
Yeah, what is it? It's the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai said that Jerusalem is a port city on the shore of eternity. Which I quite like, because it really gets to tell you that this is a city that almost feels like it's been there forever. And of course, it has undergone a number of destructions and rebuilding all the way up. I mean, and what is fascinating is how many, I think Rabbi Perlmutter mentioned this, that you can see so many of these layers still today, the different cultural influences, the different historical periods, the different ethnic groups that pass through. And even today, I mean, you turn a corner and you can go from, you know, one quarter into another. The old city is divided into, as was mentioned, four quarters: the Christian quarter, the Muslim quarter, the Armenian quarter, and the Jewish quarter. But within that are almost like micro neighborhoods as well. And all of these reflect something about the history of the city. And that's why, you know, people go there, maybe spend just a day there or go on a walking tour. But actually, what's important in Jerusalem is to just get lost in Jerusalem, is to just walk through it. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I specialize in the Roman period. So for me, it was very exciting to see this burnt house, for example, which was destroyed. You can see the evidence of this house that was destroyed in 70 when the city went on fire, and, you know, the temple was destroyed for the last time by the Romans. And you can see this house and the evidence of this house. But then you walk up and you turn a few corners and you can see these examples of these beautiful Mamluk, you know, Muslim period doorways that are, you know, just like it's, you know, it's your neighborhood. It's quite extraordinary in that way that you can see evidence of all these different layers.
And Zalika, what do we learn from going back and looking at the Roman records and some of the sources that you're familiar with? What sense do we get of what it was like as a city during the time of the Roman occupation?
So our main, besides archaeology, I suppose we wouldn't really know very much about Jerusalem in the period without the historian Flavius Josephus, born Yosef ben Matityahu. He was a priest. He came from a priestly family in Jerusalem. He was born around 37 of the Common Era, so AD 37. He grew up in Jerusalem. And when he was about 30, in the year 66, the Roman war against the Jewish rebellion against Rome started. He was part of that. He ended up, however, in the 70s, the Common Era in Rome, became a Roman citizen, and he starts a second part of his life there, and that's his literary career. And he becomes a historian. And his first book is published in the 70s, and it's a seven-volume history of the war, of the rebellion of the Jews against Roman rule. But what he does is he starts in a much earlier period. He starts in the Hellenistic period, and he tells us all the way down to 74 with the destruction of Masada. And without him, we really wouldn't know anything. Now, Josephus has courted a lot of controversy. But if you actually read Josephus, people have called him a traitor. They've called him many other names. But actually, he's an exceptionally important historian. And if you want to understand ancient Jerusalem, if you want to understand Jerusalem of Herod, you need to pick up your Josephus, and you need to walk around Jerusalem with your Josephus in hand as well.
David, you've written more than 30 books, many of them in Hebrew. You're the acclaimed expert when it comes to the architecture, the design of the city. And you've also spent your career campaigning to preserve these important historical architectural sites. And you've raised awareness, and you've made an extraordinary contribution in that area. What elements are so... What are the most important elements that you've been fighting to preserve, and what are the most exciting elements that draw upon these elements of the ancient story that we've been talking about?
Well, almost everything which is within the old city walls is considered something which should not be touched. So there were very few fights over various buildings or neighborhoods within the old city. Most of the fights for preservation as opposed to development were outside the old city walls, mainly after 1967, after the city was unified again at that time. The question was, how holy are buildings which were built only in the 19th century and not 2,000 years ago? How do you regard Christian buildings of great importance? How do you regard Muslim buildings? Should they be preserved or shouldn't they be preserved? And the biggest battles over the development of the city outside the old city walls took place in the area which is adjacent to the Jaffa Gate, the Mamila area, which was mentioned before. The question there was whether the area should be redeveloped completely, destroyed and rebuilt, or whether a number of buildings should be preserved and changed into structures of modern uses. And this battle was very, very successful overall. Some of the most important buildings were preserved. Others of less importance were destroyed. And the whole attitude towards relatively modern buildings was very skeptical after 1967. And the main reasons for the great battles over that time were over that issue of how old are the buildings? Are they historically important or aren't they historically important? Well, almost everyone agreed that what is within the old city walls is of great architectural, historical, and religious importance.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to
take... For instance, one of the great successes, I think, in the late 20s was the battle over the preservation of the German colony, which is southwest of the old city, the preservation of the Ethiopian quarter, which is northwest of the old city, which are very beautifully designed areas which were built by the Germans, the Templars at the end of the 19th century, and the Muslims. The Ethiopian quarter is called the Ethiopian quarter because it is located very close to an Ethiopian church, but most of the buildings were actually built by Muslims at the end of the 19th century, and they have a very, very unique character. Now, Jerusalem is also well known in architecture for its modern Bauhaus structures, which are different from those in most other places in the world. They are not built in concrete, but they were built in stone. And the Bauhaus buildings in stone are relatively rare in the world.
Very good. Okay, well, we're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring the photography of Jerusalem and continuing to explore the history of the ancient city of Jerusalem.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we debate the history of Jerusalem. And I'm delighted to be joined on the phone by Dr. Issam Nassar of the Department of History at Illinois State University. He's an expert on the history of the modern Middle East and is an historian of photography. And he's the author of Gardens of Sand. And earlier this year, he published the article Partition Jerusalem, The Fate of the Palestinians Who Remained in West Jerusalem. Issam, you're very welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you.
Can I begin by asking you why the city of Jerusalem is both historically and spiritually significant to Islam?
Okay. First of all, I would like to start by saying that, Jerusalem is important for many religions and is connected to three main religions, for sure. But what makes Jerusalem a city is actually that it's a place, a social place where people live and interact. And, of course, the religiosity comes with that. You know, if there was no city called Jerusalem, then there will not be a conquest of it, or there will not be, Jesus will not be in it, or, you know. So it's important to always keep that in mind, not to only focus on religion. But to answer your question more specifically, Islam, when it emerged, it saw itself as a continuation of Christianity and Judaism. So, in principle, anything that is important in the Jewish and Christian tradition was considered important in Islam. So the centrality of Jerusalem in those traditions was from the beginning transformed into a centrality for Islam. So early on, Muslims used to pray facing Jerusalem, and that's what's called the Qibla, until eventually that was a little bit later changed to become Mecca. So they will be facing Mecca. So from the beginning, there was this idea that Jerusalem is central. Of course, there are other elements that in the Quran, it's mentioned not exactly with the name Jerusalem per se, but it's understood that the references are to Jerusalem. The references are to certain locations in Jerusalem. There is also the famous in the Quranic story. Of course, we cannot verify any of that stuff, but in the Quran, the miraculous journey of Prophet Muhammad to Jerusalem and from Jerusalem to heaven, where he met face to face with God, Jesus, and Moses. So it became, in kind of engulfed in the mythical aspect of Islam, much more than any other city. You know, the connection of Islam to other holy cities like Medina is an actual historical connection, not spiritual, from the beginning. Now, of course, as a city, which would later on fall under the rule of Islam as early in, by a little bit before the mid of the 7th century, Islam was a religion of cities. I mean, not the religion, but the community of Islam was very much a city-oriented community. You know, it's formed by merchants, people who traveled to various places. So in being an important city in the location, you know, in Palestine or in southern Syria at the time, of course, it received all sort of significance. As a city, lots of attention was paid to it, especially in the end of the 7th century, more or less, when Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock were built by the caliphs as the third holiest place for Islam, marking the spot from which presumably the Prophet Muhammad ascended to the sky.
And it's interesting because you mentioned the mosque. There are also these other notable sacred Muslim sites located in the old city of Jerusalem, so that there are many places that have a special meaning and resonance.
Certainly. There are many historical mosques, first of all, that were built at different times in history. Jerusalem was an important location for Sufi Muslims, mystical Muslims, and Sufis always have built some sort of, it's called Zawiya, but it's some sort of, not exactly monastery or mosque, but it combines the it's a meeting place, prayer place, ritualistic place. And there's so many of these zawiyas in Jerusalem that go back to various periods in Islamic history. There are, of course, many other sites that were connected to pre-Islamic prophets that are recognized by Islam that were turned into mosques, like the tomb of King David, for example, or Prophet David, and other areas. So, yeah, practically the city of Jerusalem is full of locations connected to Islam. And of course, I forgot to mention the number of cemeteries in which presumably important historical figures in Islam that go back as early as the 7th century were buried in there.
You're an historian of photography as well. How important do you think the visual images that we have, how important do you think they are in shaping our perspectives on the history?
I would say very important. Early on, after the invention of photography in the first half of the 19th century, photography was a bulky business, and we didn't have our cell phones to take pictures or our Kodak cameras or whatever it is. It was you needed to travel abroad with heavy equipment, with know-how in chemistry, in lenses, in cameras, etc. So it was not an easy thing. So people were seeing, people abroad at least, were seeing the images that were produced by professionals. And those professionals often, when they went to Jerusalem, they documented holy sites or locations mentioned in the Bible. And they kind of missed. I mean, on occasion, you will see a Palestinian or an old man here and there, or a bread seller. But in general, the city appeared in these images as a dreamland connected with the Bible only. And somehow, it did not appear as a city inhabited by people. And I think that created, over time, an imagination of Jerusalem as a city that needs to be reclaimed on behalf of the, whether the Christians or the Jews or others, but in a sense as a location rather than as an inhabited city with society, with economy, with all sorts of things. So I think it contributed. It's not the only thing, but it contributed to the eventual colonization of the city later on in the 20th century.
And finally, can I ask you to reflect on the city today and the sense of Jerusalem being a contested city? How do you think about Jerusalem in this 21st century?
Well, the situation today is extremely dire, mostly because the city, first of all, in 48 was divided into two sides, and one side became the Israeli Jerusalem, West Jerusalem, in which most of the Palestinians, almost all of the Palestinians were expelled, or if they left, were not allowed to return. So that part of the city is extremely, it's Israeli in its social, political, etc. The other side is the Jerusalem that remained under Jordan until 1967 and became a mostly Arab Jerusalem, occupied by Israel in 67, and Israel has been trying to basically remove as many Palestinians, or let's just say Judaize that part of the city. So in a sense, you have a privileged population living on one side, and you have another population that is endangered continuously. So there is a great sense of inequality. If you look at the city when it comes to Palestinian neighborhoods, not only is it neglected, but you have police and army and soldiers and, real danger somehow. And it's sad because I think in this particular case, we are witnessing the misuse of religious history or religious collective memory on all sides, I have to say. Because, at the end of the day, it's a place where people should have the right to live in a city, enjoy it in peace, rather than feeling threatened because apparently a couple thousand years ago or a thousand years ago or more, a prophet passed by here or there. This is a kind of disgrace, and it's very sad. And instead of having the city that is connected to Judaism, Christianity, and Islam as a symbol of unity, symbol of humanity, it seems like Jerusalem was so unlucky to become a holy city rather than the opposite.
Okay, well, thanks a million for joining us tonight, Dr. Issam Nassar of the Department of History at Illinois State University. We'll be back with more on the history of Jerusalem after this break.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History as we look at the history of the ancient city of Jerusalem. Before the break there, we heard from Dr. Issam Nassar, and I'm delighted to be rejoined by our panel for the show, Rabbi Dr. Chaim Perlmutter, David Kroyanker, Dr. Zilika Rogers, and the Deputy Ambassador of the Embassy of Israel in Dublin, Orly Weitzman. Zilika, can I ask you about, maybe a question about the temple and the destruction of the temple in, I think, the year 70. That seems to be a pivotal moment in the history of the ancient city.
Yes, it is indeed. It was destroyed in 70 by the Romans in a huge conflagration. And of course, that ended the sacrificial cult within Judaism and, of course, also self-determination, really, in the Holy Land. for the Jews. So at the time, it was a massive catastrophe. But of course, in Jewish history, it's seen as a seminal catastrophic moment as well. The temple had been destroyed by the Babylonians in 586 BCE. Now it's destroyed again in 70 CE. And it becomes known as the Churban, the destruction. And every year, the destruction of Jerusalem is commemorated by Jews on Tisha B'Av, which is this day of mourning. At the time, for the Romans, it was actually very important as well. It was destroyed by this Titus, who was leading the troops at the time. His father, Vespasian, had ended up becoming emperor in 69. Very surprising, because they weren't part of the Flavian dynasty who had ruled Rome up until then. So all of a sudden, they have a victory on their hands, and they can say, look, we are legitimate emperors now, because we have destroyed these rebels out in the east. And of course, they have the Arch of Titus in the center of Rome, which you can see today. So for them, it was very important at the time. And actually, for the Christians, it became important, because what they looked back and said was, because the Jews did not believe in Jesus and because they crucified him, Jerusalem was destroyed. So for all of for Jews, Christians, and for the Romans, it was a very important moment. I should say that Josephus says that in trying to explain all this, people often think he was a Roman propagandist. But he says very clearly, let's not think that the Romans destroyed Jerusalem, or that the Roman gods were victorious. This was the Jewish God punishing his people, and that is why the temple was destroyed.
Very interesting. Orly, it's also a city that's of crucial importance in terms of Jewish identity and culture. It seems to be very much tied up with identity and culture.
Absolutely. So as Alika mentioned, the pivotal moment of the destruction of the temple, I think really... It really sort of still shapes how Jews feel today about Jerusalem all over the world. I think since those times, basically, or since even Babylonian times, we've been praying for returning to Jerusalem. We've been praying for living in Jerusalem, and this has been following us throughout history for thousands of years. And each year during Passover, we finished the Passover saying next year in Jerusalem. And this has been going on again, telling the story of the exile of the Jews from Egypt. And this is commemorated every year. And for years, even when Israel, before Israel got its independence in 1948, still people were yearning for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and thousands of years to return to Jerusalem. So it's very, very important in the Jewish identity. And I think it's really a part of who we are. Jerusalem is a really important part of being Israeli, of being Jewish. So it has a very big importance to Judaism and to Israelis.
David, it's very interesting what the Deputy Ambassador was saying there about the different communities, because as your work shows, and what's very interesting is the way there were these strong Jewish communities in Jerusalem long before the creation of the State of Israel, and that's an important part of the story as well.
The development of the city outside the old city was actually initiated at the end of the 19th century by Jewish Orthodox families who left the old city because of the very bad living conditions there, and established new neighborhoods, communities outside the old city. These were Orthodox Jews which built Me'ah Shearim and many other neighborhoods which are in north of the Damascus Gate. And they were really, to a certain degree, the first ones who started to develop the city outside the old city walls. And today, many of these communities are very interesting also in terms of architecture, because some of them, and mainly the Me'ah Shearim area and the Batei Ungarim community, which is adjacent to it, are in their urban structure very similar to Jewish ghettos in Eastern Europe at the 18th and 19th century. Some of them are replicas of the urban texture from East European communities. The other developers of the city outside the old city were the German Templars, which I mentioned before, which initiated the development of the German colony. There were also a number of developments by Muslims north of the Damascus Gate. And the most modern 20th century developments were built west of the city in communities like Rehavia, which was mainly developed by German Jews who escaped Nazism in the 1930s, and other garden city developments like Beit HaKerem, Beit Vegan, and similar neighborhoods in the northwest of Jerusalem. So the architecture of these communities is very, very different, which also makes Jerusalem a very interesting city in terms of different styles of urban development and texture.
And Rabbi Haim, it is interesting when you hear David talking there about some of these developments, because that's one of the extraordinary things about the city, the way with each of the archaeological digs, with the excavations, you're finding artifacts, you're finding, in one case, I think there was an underground street, they found skeletons of rebels who were hiding, you find a fortress, that there's a whole history underneath the history that you see on the streets.
Yes, that I mentioned earlier that they found a whole street under the street. But I could add now something that I didn't mention before. What it's relatively an older finding. I studied for a number of years, and afterwards I taught there in a place called Yeshivat HaKotel, the Western Wall Yeshiva, which is directly above the steps that lead down from what was called the Upper City to the Temple area, the Temple Mount. That yeshiva, by the way, every Friday night, the boys used to. Now it's not every Friday night. You have to be lucky, because sometimes they go up to their roof. But every Friday night, they would dance down to the Western Wall Plaza, singing Sabbath songs, and after they would pray at the Western Wall, they would dance back up. But back to what we were saying, underneath that yeshiva, there's they discovered the Herodian Quarter, which was actually where the wealthy priests lived during the Second Temple period, and there you find very unique creations, you could say. That means on one hand, you would find Roman architecture, you would find atrium like in the Roman villas, but on the other hand, you would find many items that would show how technology was used for purity. In this urban setting, there were many ritual baths for these priests to bathe in before they would go to perform their work in the temple. And in addition, they found even stone vessels. That means they would make their pots and their plates and their cups out of stone. Because in Jewish law, if an earthenware vessel is touched by something impure, it becomes...
Yeah, sorry?
Yeah, hello?
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we may have a call coming through there.
No,
okay,
oh, sorry. Some interference.
Oh, sorry, okay. Yes. Please continue, sorry.
Right. Yeah, so if you have, in Jewish law, a vessel, the earthenware vessel, a clay vessel, pottery, that was touched by something impure has to be broken. It can't even be immersed in a ritual bath in order to be pure. But a stone vessel never becomes impure. So they actually had a whole industry of making vessels, household vessels, out of stone in order that it would maintain its purity, and they would neither have to immerse it in the ritual bath, nor would they have to break it when it became impure,
and they could continue using it for a long period of time. Right. These kind of vessels were found also in the Galilee from after 70, that was in use of Jews that wanted, were aspiring to come back to Jerusalem and renew the work in the temple, even after 70, after the temple was destroyed.
Very good. I might bring Zulika here. Elizabeth and Rahini has texted in to News Talk on 53106 to say that she's really enjoying the show. Top of my bucket list to get there. And she says, I pray I will get there. Well, I suppose in these extraordinary global times, we all hope we'll be able to travel to many far off places. But Zulika, to someone who's thinking of going to Jerusalem and obviously now is unable to, what would you recommend that they would read?
Well, of course, Josephus. So it's not like I'm biased or anything, but I suppose my first love, Josephus. And then my second would be Yotam Ottolenghi's Jerusalem, which, as you know, is a cookbook, but also tells the stories of many different communities in Jerusalem as well through various dishes. It really tells about all the different ethnic groups and cultures as well. I did mention the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai, who had said that Jerusalem was a port city on the shore of eternity. He also called it the Venice of God. And he writes about things like politics and going grocery shopping in Jerusalem. So if you like poetry, I would read him and also the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish as well.
Very good. And it is an ancient city that I think will continue to inspire precisely for all of the reasons that we've discussed.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. I think Jerusalem is just one of those places that has to be on everyone's list to go to.
Okay, well, my thanks to my brilliant panel of experts, the Deputy Ambassador of the Embassy of Israel, Orly Weitzman, Dr. Zulika Rogers, David Cryanker, Rabbi Dr. Haim Perlmutter, Dr. Issam Nassar also joined us. That is the end of another show of Talking History. My thanks to my producer, Susan Cahill, Peter Malloy on sound. Next week, we'll explore the enigma of Arthur Griffith, find out about war and disease in Europe in the 17th and 18th centuries, and examine the history of the emotion anger. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.